understood. 806 Hudson Valley Focus Live on this Friday morning. Let me go to the telephone and say good morning and welcome to Rich Ellenbogen regarding New York's energy plans. Good morning, Rich.
Morning, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for spending time with us this morning. And Rich, you've been deeply involved in the energy situation. You also, though, are a business owner. Can you spend a couple of minutes and just talk about your business ownership and how you have, really embraced energy conservation, efficiency, et cetera? Rich?
Well, first, I think you have to sort of understand my background. I have a master's degree in electrical engineering from Cornell, and when I graduated there, I went to work for Bell Labs, where I was responsible for the power supplies that ran 90% of the phones in the United States. So I left there and then went to work with my dad, and we renovated the building. He had passed away by that point. In 1999, and when I was doing it, I was aware that energy was a big deal even back 25 years ago, and I wanted it to be sustainable. So I started implementing the infrastructure for adding more on-site generation. And over the course of the next 8 years, by 2007, we had replaced 75%, or actually about 70% of Con Ed's generation. At that point, I've since upped it to about close to 75 to 80%. And this year, I'm going to do a project that may take us entirely off the electric grid. And our carbon footprint is 30% to 40% lower than Con Ed's. The DOE says the new project will reduce that by another 24%. And our bills are actually going down while everyone else's are going up. So
yeah, and this is
that's one thing.
This takes planning and foresight,
yeah.
and I guess it's really important, as I say often, following the laws of physics and science plays a big role in this, Rich.
It is a huge role. And then in 2008, when I was doing all this, I saw something on the service engines at our factory based upon all the renewables we had installed and inverter-based generation. And I called it to Con Ed's attention. They asked me to write a paper, which I did. The Public Service Commission turned it into a utility conference. And I was trying to warn them about excess of inverter-based generation on the utility grid. But it also relates to ways to save large amounts of energy on the transmission lines, and which they implemented. But the thing that brought down Spain's grid back in April was the fact that they were overly reliant on the inverter-based generation, which I warned the state about in 2008. But now New York State is trying to duplicate what they did in Spain.
Yes.
And it's going to have the same negative impact because you can't defy physics. And they just seem to think that physics is, something they can legislate away, which I tried to warn them when I addressed them in March at the state Senate energy hearing.
That's the point I've tried to drive home for years and years and years. I do not have the, master's background that you have in this, but it has been something that's been near and dear to me since I was in my early teens at the start of the space race.
Yeah.
And it's something I've tried to follow along with. And how we educate the public, Rich, I was in a meeting in Ulster County a couple of years ago now, and there were, maybe 60 people there and with so-called energy experts. The people there, the majority of them, when you listen to their conversation, they were convinced that we could just shut down our generating plants and just go green. But that's the indoctrination that's been heaped on people for years and years and years. Rich?
Well, unfortunately, and I read documentation very differently than other people do because of my background, but there's too much stuff in the media and even in the scientific, the media is basing their information off scientists. There has been too much stuff in the scientific documentation where I can see there's a fallacy in it from the get-go. For instance, the gas stove argument where it causes childhood asthma and a whole bunch of other stuff. And they use a mathematical tool called population attributable fraction. Well, that only works with one risk factor. However, if you look how many risk factors there are for childhood asthma, they're up to 17, so the tool breaks down. So basically, and plus they took 30 to 40-year-old data. Now, you can get around the one risk factor part of population attributable fraction if you collect the data to isolate the other risk factors. But that can't be done with 40-year-old data that wasn't collected for that purpose. So the whole study was basically a conclusion in search of a document.
Yes.
And they had their conclusion, and then they basically, I hate to say they made it up, but they made it up.
Yes,
and then recently Stanford came up with a similar thing, that gas stoves cause diabetes and lung cancer and all that other stuff. Well, if you look, I subscribe to statistics websites so I can check these things. If you look at the occurrences of childhood asthma, for instance, five states use predominantly gas stoves. New York is highest on that list at number 28, which means the top 27 states in the country for childhood asthma use electric stoves. All right? And so, if childhood asthma was such a large risk factor for gas stoves, then the five states with gas stoves would show up much higher on that list. But one of them shows up at like 48, 46, 28, 30, and 37 are where the five states show up. Okay? So none of them are anywhere near the top of the list for childhood asthma. And this is the documentation that's being used to support these policies. And the politicians aren't educated in these things, so they take the scientists at their word, and then they pass bad policy. And the CLCPA, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, is a similarly bad policy. And when, you know, I was minding my own business, running my business back in 2019, and the gas moratorium started in Westchester County, partly because of them trying to enforce the CLCPA. And so I started paying attention to what was going on, and I looked at it, and over the course of two nights, literally 8 hours, I ran an analysis, a numerical analysis of what they were doing, and it took me about 4 hours to collect the data, 2 hours to collect do the analysis, and another 2 hours to redo it five times, because I literally couldn't believe they had passed something so stupid, so I was sure I was wrong. But then I ran it five more times, and it turns out my numbers were right. Then I presented them to the state, and the person that took me up there was a former politician, and he was a lobbyist. And what wound up happening is when we went up there, he was expecting us to get thrown out of the room because what I was telling them was totally different than what everyone else was saying. And all they did was look down at the table because the numbers had been so politicized, the engineers knew they were wrong.
Yes.
But they couldn't say anything because they would have lost their pensions.
They
would have been fired. Pensions.
And this is unbelievable. So I want to back up one second. On the phone with me, Rich Ellenbogen, we're talking about, you know, New York's misguided actions. So, So when I look at one of the worst public housing agencies in the entire United States is NYCHA, New York City Housing Authority, mm-hmm. with tens of thousands of open violations. So they want to blame gas stoves for childhood asthma, but what does the data show? Oh, let me see. Rodent droppings in NYCHA housing are serious issues requiring action from both residents and management. NYCHA mold exposure is a widespread issue stemming from leaks and condensation causing tenant health problems like respiratory issues, significant property damage leading to lawsuits and federal oversight of these parts. This has gone on for decades. And this thing about the gas stove is a very convenient way to divert the public's attention from decades of failure to manage these public housing authorities. And Rich, the point that you just made about these engineers who testify or the politicians who go out with these studies, these are criminal actions directed at people who are stuck in these public housing authorities. Rich?
Well, like I said, there are 17, at least 17 risk factors for childhood asthma.
Yes.
And mold would certainly qualify. But another thing that you have to think about is that diet is a significant contributor to asthma and the diabetes that this recent Stanford study started talking about. And if you look, people in public housing generally have lower incomes and are more and have a more compromised food supply.
Absolutely.
So they're not going to be eating as well. They're going to be eating far more processed foods that are higher in sugars, and that is going to negatively impact their health prospects.
Yep.
So these are all things that contribute to that. And you know, it's interesting because my daughter moved to the city recently, and she had, you know, she had a gas stove, and the building was 23 years old, and the valves leaked a little bit. But the point is that we replaced the stove, and it was like $800 from Home Depot to get a new one delivered, the old one taken out, and have it all connected.
Yes.
Soup to nuts.
So Rich Ellenbogen on the phone with me. Rich, let me jump in 1 second. We need to get a real quick quarter hour sports break in here, station ID, and you'll come back with me, and we'll continue this all important conversation about energy. Back in a minute on the Beacon. I think it's time we stop, children. 8:21, Huntsman Life Focus Live on the Beacon on this Friday morning. Back to my conversation with Rich Ellenbogen talking about New York's climate action. And, Rich, I think when you and I spoke on the phone the other day, you know, you were talking, you said to me about, I would classify this as what a good job we have already done in New York in terms of cleaning up our air, cleaning up our water. I certainly have seen in my lifetime huge changes. And we contribute so little to, you know, whether we're talking about CO2. Explain that, if you will, please.
Okay, well, one of the reasons they're saying that we have to execute the Climate Act is to reduce New York's carbon footprint.
Right.
However, New York accounts for only 0.004 of the global carbon emissions, and our entire emissions profile of 350 million metric tons is added back to the atmosphere by the third world and more every year.
Yes.
So we could literally cut our entire carbon footprint and have absolutely no effect on climate change. But this gets into cost and reliability, which I was talking about with the guest of when we went to break, is that the electrification is going to add $50,000 to $130,000 per unit of improvements, which is going to add about $300 to $800 worth of additional monthly costs if you amortize that over a 30-year financing process, which most people can't afford. They're literally living hand-to-mouth now.
Correct.
Not only that, all the recent cost increases, or a huge amount of them, are based upon trying to, you know, work in the Climate Act into improvements. It's going to require an enormous amount of infrastructure. So I've sat through two utility rate cases, and we've asked them about that because we're concerned about reliability. I don't know if people understand, but the New York Independent System Operator says that the generation margins are possibly going to go below zero as early as next year, and very likely by 2033, which means when those margins go below zero, we get a blackout. The other problem we have is that we've been borrowing a lot of energy from PJM, the Penn Jersey Maryland group, which is New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and like 15 states to the west of us and south of us. And they're out of energy because there have been so many data centers built there that they don't have any energy to loan. So that's gone. Okay, to the east of this, New England uses more energy than they generate, and we have been exporting to them historically. So the whole Northeast now is compromised in terms of having enough electricity, and the intermittent resources cannot supply it. There are times in Germany where the wind doesn't blow that they have to shut down businesses, you know, because they've gone heavily renewable, and after 32 years, they've only gotten to 34% renewable. They say 42, but 8% of that is wood burning, which has a higher carbon footprint than coal.
Absolutely.
And the way New York has gotten their carbon footprint so low is on the back of natural gas by replacing coal. Now, so all the coal combustion in the state is gone. So no one wants to burn more fossil fuels than is necessary, but the solution is not to eliminate them, it's to combust them more cleanly, which they wanted to do at Danskammer, which is close to you.
Yep.
However, that was denied, so now Danskammer is still running as a peaker plant using an old-style generation, which is more highly polluting. It could have been retooled already and completed and been burning much more cleanly, because they're not going to be able to shut these plants down, because if they do, there's not going to be enough electricity to keep the lights on, and that's the problem. They're searching for the perfect in lieu of the good, and there are ways that they can replace these older plants with newer plants, which are way less polluting and much more efficient, and that's how I've gotten the carbon footprint down in my business. By replacing Con Ed's ancient generation with very highly efficient generation, where we literally utilize about close to 75 to 80% of the heat content in the fuel. And that's how you have to do it. Because the wind and solar thing, it would be great if it would work, but it's basically a college science project that a couple of professors that got onto the Climate Action Council foisted upon the state. And they weren't engineers, they were biologists, okay, who knew absolutely nothing about the utility grid, and now we're living with it.
And when you study the life cycle of wind and solar, all the way from the extraction of the raw materials to the production to the installation to the erratic production of electricity, all the way through what the heck we do with these things at the end of their life cycle, literally the way I've looked at this, it is an environmental disaster in the long run. It truly is. That's not a political statement.
They've had a lot of problems recycling wind turbine blades. There are fields filled with them.
Yes.
Now, I recently wrote a paper because I did an analysis of my business and the solar array we have there, and to see what the return on investment was. If somebody were to install a solar array now, with the way utility prices are skyrocketing at the current cost, they would make, on average, over the course of the next 30 years, 13% on their investment, which is not a bad return.
Right.
Okay. But the reality is, the reason that's occurring is because between 2007 and 2019, 2007 I installed my solar array, so it's 19 years now.
Right.
My per kilowatt hour costs were rising 1.8% a year. They were basically tracking inflation. Now they're going up at a rate of 6 to 7% a year. And that's been verified by the New York Times in some of their reports, because electric heating costs are going up 12% this year. Okay, whereas gas heating costs are only going up about 8.
Right. When you and I spoke the other day, you also use geothermal, as
yes.
I do. And back, it's got to be 5 years ago, I did had people come and actually do a full study about looking at setting up solar to run my property. And it actually, it was going to cost me like $90,000. To care, provide about half of my electric need over the course of the year. And it, wound up putting in, a big solar field on part of my property, which would have been, looked horrible. It just did not work. There was no way for those numbers to work.
Believe it or not, over the course of 30 years, if you had planned on keeping it for 30 years,
right.
You actually would have made money on that, because the utility rates are going up so quickly.
Sure.
But I mean, you can't look at those as a short-term investment. But solar arrays last 25, 30 years.
Right.
Wind turbines inherently, especially offshore wind, which you're sticking in, putting a spinning machine in the middle of salt water
right.
is never a good idea.
Yep.
I mean, it's going to require so much maintenance that nobody looks at, and it's one of the reasons that the offshore wind bids for New York State came in basically at $145 a megawatt hour, that they wanted to build off the coast of Long Island.
Exactly.
And the regular energy is running about $50 to $70 a megawatt right. hour. Nuclear, the actual cost of nuclear is only $30 a megawatt hour once you get the plant
Rich,
built.
Excuse me a second. I was neglectful here watching the clock. We're up against the hard break at 8:30.
Okay.
Can you just hold through and come back and spend just a couple more minutes with me, and then let me know how people can learn more about the things that you and I spoke about?
Sure.
Okay, back in a minute with Rich Ellenbogen here on The Beacon. A35 Hudson Valley Focus Live on The Beacon. Back to my conversation with Rich Ellenbogen. During the break, Rich, I went back and I looked up to see when the proposal was from Sunrun. I can't believe it was 7 years ago already. And, of course, at that point, I was already, 71 years old. So that 30-year payback wasn't exactly going to work for me.
Come on. You're going to live to 105.
Exactly. So, but it was, it says offset approximately 51% of your electricity usage is what was then. But it would have taken up a big chunk of my side yard that, you know, with those solar arrays out there. And it's just not something that I wanted to do. But I say this because of the fact that, you know, in some instances, it can work for certain individuals. I ran the entire exercise and all the way to the point where, you know, we looked at the outright purchase. We looked at leasing. And in my circumstance, no, it just didn't work. But I've always been interested in it. So Rich Ellenbogen, go ahead.
At the factory, it worked well. For me, at the factory, it worked well.
Yes.
But it's going to reach end of life in about 9 or 10 years, and I'm going to have to do something else. So,
sure, sure. You know. So how do folks learn more about New York's Climate Action Plan? How do they learn more about the kind of work that you do? And
I have a website up.
Okay.
And it's www.savenyenergy.com. And there's another person named Roger Cayaza who has a website, the New York Pragmatic Environmentalist, NYPRAG, and the rest. And he was a utility air quality specialist for about 40 years. So he's very knowledgeable, and he has a lot of information about it. Some of it's technical. Some of my information is technical. But on my website, to Save NY Energy, there's a video. I rented out a movie theater to get the word across to people for 2 hours and change. And the video is up there, and it has a PowerPoint that explains all the issues with New York's plan. And one of the bases of the cost returns on the CLCPA is, and it's in Appendix G of the CLCPA, says that New York State is going to save $280 billion on climate-averted damage by reducing carbon emissions. Well, that doesn't work if everybody else is putting carbon into the atmosphere faster than you can take it out. So the $280 billion that we were supposed to get back isn't going to happen, and so all these costs are being put onto the backs of the ratepayers. So if you're upset about your rates going up, don't believe that all the garbage that everybody's telling you. Most of it is because of the Climate Act and all the infrastructure that has to be added to support it.
Yes.
And that's one of the problems we have with it, is that we already have some of the most expensive utility rates in the country, and those are going to go higher.
Yes.
Like I said, my utility rates in my factory were tracking inflation until 2020, and then Indian Point closed and there was COVID. But now they're going up at a rate on average of 6% per year. And that is all, or actually 6.6%, close to 7%, that is all after the passage of the Climate Act, and the closure of Indian Point and COVID are now no longer being factored in, and they're still going up at that rate. And that is part of the problem. This is costing everybody 4% per year.
Yeah. And Rich, I have your website, savenyenergy.com, and what was the second one that you said?
New York, NY, Pragmatic Environmentalist.
Okay. Okay. And
it's Roger Cayaza.
Okay.
Cayazza.
About.
And it's a very good website. He's very knowledgeable.
Okay. And then it looks like I Pragmatic Environmentalist of New York blog. I came up with that one.
Yeah, that's it.
So, okay, good. Well, good. Well, we can repost this information. I appreciate the work that you're doing, and I applaud you for, you know, first of all, having a business here in the state of New York. You know, I've spoken often over the years about the business owners who have to contend with the ever-ending New York regulation, over-regulation, labor law provisions, you name it. And it's certainly difficult to keep up with all of that, as well as then you trying to keep up with these regulatory changes that would further impact your business. Your core business that you said, the factory, tell me again, tell the listeners again what that core business is.
We make industrial food packaging.
Okay.
So if you go to a supermarket and get something in a wrapper, it may have come from our factory in New Rochelle.
Okay.
And the only reason we're able to stay in Westchester is because I've driven my utility costs down to a point where they're about as expensive as Utah. Because we're only paying $1.19 a square foot for our total energy bill, and if you look at the average for the Northeast United States for our type of business, it runs between $4 and $7 a square foot.
Wow.
So we are literally below 33% of the cost
right.
for our utility bills. And
right.
part of that is because we have gotten so energy efficient.
Yes.
And not only that, we recycle 99% of our industrial byproducts. So we have sent one container of waste out of the building in the last year, and one container the year before that. Prior to COVID, we sent none. We recycled 100%, but COVID broke some of the supply chains.
Sure.
So we couldn't recycle some of the stuff.
What's interesting, Rich, I do a lot of work with the Council of Industry Manufacturers Trade Group here in the Hudson Valley, and when I visit their manufacturers and from the environmental standpoint, whether we're talking about, you know, scrubbing the air within these facilities that people are working in, whether we're talking about, you know, using, water-based solvents for, you know, on their metal lathe production equipment, but then recycling almost all of that, and then the metals that are shaved off, recycling 100% of that. I think people would be really surprised to see how much small businesses have invested in increasing efficiency and the concern about the environment and the safety of the workers working in these plants. Rich?
Well, I think there's two aspects to that. One is there is definitely environmental impact, and there's the knowledge that you're doing the right thing. There's also a huge return on investment for these things.
Yes.
Well, not so much the scrubbers. The scrubbers are there because you have to, and also it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the, you know, when you recover all the metal and when we recover all our waste, beyond what we get for selling it back to people to reuse, there's also the fact that we're not paying to throw it out. So I'm literally saving about $100,000 a year on tipping fees.
Yes.
For the stuff that we're recycling. So there's an economic return, and obviously by becoming more environmentally efficient, all of that stuff is paid for, it's more energy efficient, all that stuff is paid for itself, and it's saving us a huge amount of money every year. You know, so there's an economic return on investment for doing it. And yes, there's an upfront cost, but if you're going to, one of the problems I've found with American businesses is that they look for at too short a time frame.
Correct.
So if you're looking at the 2 or 3 or 4 year time frame, then some of these things don't make any sense. But if you're looking at, a 10-year time frame, they make a lot of sense. And if my dog barks, somebody just let him into the room where I'm hanging out. So,
but I'll close the conversation because what you just highlighted is the I guess I'll call it the advantage or the free market economy that we operate in, where out of economic necessity, your skin in the game to find every one of these, percentage factors that allows you to remain competitive in the marketplace, to be able to hire people. And when we look at, we were talking a couple minutes ago about the New York City Housing Authority, how poorly run that is. The people who run it have no skin in the game. And that mm-hmm. is the difference between a government takeover of a utility or a housing project versus the free market ability to produce products. So,
well, I think one of the, I think anybody that thinks that they can take over utility and run it is showing a ridiculous amount of hubris.
Exactly.
Because you never understand a business until you know the details.
Exactly.
And I have a degree in electrical engineering. I've written papers for the Public Service Commission on utility issues. I've run a business for 50 years.
Yep.
I would not want to take over a utility. It's just a whole different ball of wax than what I'm doing. And I probably am more qualified to do it than the people that think they want to do it.
I would think so. Rich Ellenbogen, I thank you very much for spending time with us here this morning. I'll let you drop off, but I look forward to additional conversations with you. And on Wednesday, I had mentioned to you that Alex Panagiotopoulos was on with me as well. So we're going to continue this.
I'll listen to that. Okay.
Thanks. Okay. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Quick break and then back to wrap it up on this Friday morning on The Beacon.